It's going to be great. Great job. Be sure you tell him how great I am. Good. I mumbled that. I'm joking for those listening on the podcast. We're sponsoring the speaker meetings the next month. It's going to be good. Stu's going to talk on the 15th.
Awesome.
That'll be great. So, and welcome to our new person, Emily. We hope you get something out of it. And congratulations again to Lenny. That was powerful. On Wednesday nights, that's tonight, right? We've started the big book over, and we're on There Is a Solution. And on Saturdays, we're at a different part of the book. We're on the fourth step, and we covered fear last week. And on Sunday nights, we're finishing the chapter Working with Others. For those who came Sunday night, I hope you had a good meeting. It was a blizzard, and somebody said, am I having a meeting? I said, it's a blizzard. We're not having a meeting. And so somebody said, well, we need to announce it. I said, we're not going to put it during the ball game. The DAA meeting is canceled. So Stu said he came by and nobody was here. He was driving around. So anyway, that's our snow plan. Blizzards, we cancel the meeting. Tonight we're reading powerful pages that have changed the world. We're on page 26, and just a little bit about, for those who are new and old, it's always good to remind ourselves what we're actually reading here. We're reading this book called Alcoholics Anonymous that was written and published in early 1939. It was written in 1938, and it was written by a whole bunch of people. They say Bill W. wrote it, but he had a lot of help and a lot of information, especially from the Oxford Group, which was a group of people trying to live a Christian life in the first century. And they had six steps, and they had the four absolutes. The book is put together so that we covered the foreword, which told us how we're going to, this is for seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, people who are dying. And to show them how they recovered is why they wrote this book. It's a testimony. It's like we have the New Testament, we have the AA Testament. And then doctor's opinion told us what was wrong with us, remember? The allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And that we drink or use because we want to change how we feel. Anybody relate to that? And once we drink or use, we're screwed because our bodies won't stop. We have an allergy. And so that's the doctor's opinion, and he hints at the solution in there, that it's a change in our whole personality. Then the next chapter that was written, and remember this book was meant to be read in order, and it was to give you the precise directions on how they recovered. The next chapter is a story of hope. It's called Bill's Story. It's the story of someone who had a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. The first eight pages describe his hopeless condition of mind and body. And it was hopeless. And then something happened. God sent someone to him to tell him the message of the Oxford Group. And then he went in the hospital in 1934, and he worked the steps, and we're here today. And it's a message of hope. It shows you the specific things he did. And it's powerful stuff. So you've read that, you've read the doctor's opinion, you know what's wrong with you now. You have a message of hope. So then the next chapter, cleverly, is called There Is a Solution. Now, AA doesn't say this is the only solution, but this is their solution. So if you have a better solution, good. Usually people have better solutions don't come to AA, right? Their plan didn't work. The best thing about this solution, it's not talked about enough, but it's the absolute best thing about it, is it's not mine. It's not my solution. It's their solution. My solution would never worked. And we covered the first four or five pages of this chapter, which tells us, the first page tells us a powerful thing. I cannot recover just by fellowship alone. Just having a common peril, just being with alcoholics and going to meetings with alcoholics is great. We have a common peril. But the solution, the thing that holds us together, is the program of recovery, the way out. So you can have fellowship, and the fellowship in the way this book was written is the fellowship was to bring you to the program and the solution. And then they talked about our bodies and how when we drink, we cannot control how much we drink. Anybody have that problem? Let's bring a few kegs in here and see what happens. Let's look at the parking lot in a few hours. Then it talks powerfully in a few pages about there's something wrong with our mind because we take the first drink. Now, why would we ever take the first drink if we know it's going to cause all these problems? Nobody's saying anything. Because our mind tells us it's okay. And it tells us it's okay because we can't remember the humiliation and defeat of even a moment ago. And it says we are without defense against the first drink. Now, if you're reading this, and it says that on page 24, that is a bad thing. Now, a lot of people read that and says, well, they didn't have a defense against the first drink, but I know when the time comes, I'll be able to handle it. That's not what it says. It says at certain times, you don't know what that certain time is, you will not be able to keep from drinking if you're an alcoholic. Why? Because your mind will tell you it's okay, it's been damaged. So then we get to page 25, which we read last week, which tells us about the solution. And it says we're going to do certain things and we're going to change our whole attitude towards life and we're going to get a relationship with God that will change us and direct us to live a different way. Anybody think that's a good idea? Yes. Right. So that's page 25. And now on the rest of the chapter, we're going to see where the solution came from. The problem came to us from Dr. Silkworth. He was a doctor. He wasn't an alcoholic. He told Bill W., told Dr. Bob, what was wrong with us? We have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, and we drink to change how we feel. Bill didn't know that. He thought he was just a mess. And then we got the steps from the Oxford group. But now we're going to see where the solution came from. That we solves our problem. And it came from Dr. Jung in Switzerland, and we're going to read on page 26. And it says, a certain American businessman, this man's name was Roland Hazard. This was about 1932 or 33 when this man went to Switzerland. He had ability, good sense, and high character. We don't know if that's true, but that's what he thought. He couldn't have had good sense because he kept drinking, right? For years he had floundered, notice the word floundered, from one sanitarium to another. So he was in and out of sanitariums. He had a severe problem living life and he couldn't live sober. He had consulted the best known American psychiatrists. They couldn't help him. So he was very wealthy. He was from Providence, Rhode Island. His family owned everything. They were ship magnates. They were very wealthy people like the Rockefellers. They sent him to Europe. They wanted to send him to Freud, but Freud was too busy. Now, if he had gone to Freud, we'd all be on couches today. And we'd be discussing our problems. And we love to do that, but we'd all be drunk. But he was sent to this Dr. Jung, who was the preeminent, one of the preeminent psychiatrists in the world. And so he went to Switzerland, who prescribed for him. Now, it doesn't say what he prescribed for him, but he was going for a solution to this problem he had. And it said, though experience had made him skeptical, that's the patient. He was skeptical because they never worked. He'd seen everybody, right? He finished his treatment with unusual self-knowledge. Well, now the treatment was to understand himself better, to see the inner workings of his mind so that he could manage those difficult times. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. He felt great. He'd been there a year. He's sober. He hasn't drank. He's feeling good. And here's above all. So above all, he believed, and this is what he believed, He had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind. The inner workings, I don't know what the outer workings are, but the inner workings is what get us in trouble. And it's hidden springs. How do you like the words here? The hidden springs, the springs that'll come up and give us that relapse was unthinkable. He believed this. If you gave him a lie detector test, he would have passed. He was great. It sounds good, doesn't it? Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. Now, the stories are that he left Switzerland and he got to Paris, and somebody asked him if he wanted a glass of wine. He said, no problem, and he was off and running. Some say he never got out of Switzerland. We don't know. But he went back to Dr. Jung, and he could not give himself any satisfactory explanation for his fall. Now, when we drink again after we decide we're going to quit, do we ever really have a satisfactory explanation? It doesn't really make sense after we see what it's done to us, right? So then we say we're never going to do it again, right? And then we do it and the same thing happens over and over. So he returned to the doctor whom he admired. He liked him. And the other thing I wrote is he had a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind. What we need is a profound knowledge of God's will for us and how God will work in my mind. The inner workings of my mind is what got me here. I don't want to rely on my thinking anymore. I want to rely on God's thinking for me, how he's directing my thinking. You see the difference? So he returned to the doctor and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. So he was trying to control himself. The solution is God control, right? God controlling me, directing me, my obedience to God. The problem is God won't direct me unless I allow him. And Lenny was talking about, we have to peel away the things in us that are blocking us from God's direction. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? Well, the previous 25 pages told us why, right? He had no control over alcohol in his body or his mind. There was a part of his mind that was damaged. And whenever he felt bad or felt some uneasiness, that part of his mind would say, get a drink. Now, the problem is that part of our mind that's damaged, we don't have the ability to tell that part of our mind, shut up. We listen to it, and then we do it over and over again. That damaged part, the only thing that will tell that mind not to drink is God. I can't do it on my own. No pill will do it. No amount of therapy or self-knowledge, fear won't fix it. So he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. Now, I don't know how he spent a year with Dr. Jung, and it took Dr. Jung, didn't realize he was an alcoholic, but I have a feeling that Roland wasn't quite honest with him. I have a feeling that Roland really didn't explain the situation in great detail. Because we're very good at lying, aren't we? And actually, the best thing about alcoholics is when we lie, we think we're telling the truth. I mean, it sounds crazy, but am I the only person that did that? And he got it. He's utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society. And look, he's going to have to place himself under lock. He's going to have to lock himself up to keep from drinking or have a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was the great physician's opinion. Pretty sad, but it's true, isn't it? But this man still lives and is a free man. He's free of the bondage of alcohol. He's free of the bondage of self. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster. So that's great, isn't it? But here's the provision, provided. There's always a warning. He remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Remains, maintains a simple attitude. Anybody like that statement? But what is the simple attitude? That's probably with the big book. It's asking you questions. Well, the simple attitude is God is my director. I seek him in all things. Without him, I am nothing. I need his direction and guidance. And it starts from there. And then it follows the rest of the steps. And here, there's another warning. Some of our alcoholic readers, they're assuming people read this are alcoholics, may think they can do without spiritual help. You hear that all the time. That's why people like to go to meetings or 90 meetings in 90 days. There's nothing wrong with 90 meetings in 90 days, but it's not working the steps. The 90 meetings in 90 days is very powerful because it tells you the humility that you need help, you're willing to go to any length, but it has to be followed with action. It says, and there are people who don't want to hear about God, right? A lot of people. Why? Lenny mentioned it. Our view of God, for a lot of us, was a punishing, unforgiving God. But AA says, change that. Change your mind. Write your own conception of God. And then what AA also tells you is that God will reveal himself to you. You don't have to worry about what God is or isn't. You do the steps and you'll have a power in your life. And then you'll tell us what it is. He says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. That's not a good thing. The mind of a chronic alcoholic cannot see the truth about alcohol. We keep putting our hand on the flame. Anybody do that? It says, I've never seen one single case recover where the state of mind existed to the extent it does in you. He's pretty honest, isn't it? I took care of cancer patients, and I saw some people where I never would tell them this, but I knew the first time I saw them that they had something that I knew I didn't have any power, anybody else had the power to get rid of. I didn't say that God couldn't do it if he didn't want it, but I knew that eventually they would succumb to this. But here, there's a solution. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. So he says to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, and this is where we got the solution. This doctor had enough humility to say that he couldn't fix him. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experience. Now, vital means necessary for life. Spiritual experience, an experience with something beyond themselves. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. He couldn't explain it. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. So that's what a spiritual experience is. It's a huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. Now for me, it's very simple. I don't believe everything I think anymore. I know when I'm angry, I'm wrong. I know when I'm afraid, I'm separated from God. Sorry. All right. Somebody evaded the meeting. Huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. We see things differently, right? We look at ourselves and our responsibility and our character defects. And here it is. The ideas, emotions, and attitude, which were once the guiding forces of our lives, and look at the words, suddenly cast to one side. It says we have to let go of our old ideas. Absolutely? Is that what this says? What does absolutely mean? It means absolutely, or the result is nil. We have to let go of these ideas, emotions, and attitudes which weren't the guiding force of my life. Why? Because those ideas, emotions, and attitude guided me and made me drink. Because I didn't like the way I lived, I was afraid, I was angry, and I harmed a lot of people. Anybody have that experience? Now, they're suddenly cast to one side. Now, how do we do that? We do this because in step four, we see it. We see it all, and we want to cast it to one side and replace it with new ideas. And that's what our card's all about, right? We don't want to live on this side. When we're on the left-hand side, when we're selfish, dishonest, frightened, and considerate, pride, greedy, lustful, angry, we don't want to be that way anymore. So we say, God, change me. How can I be loving, interested in others, honest, courageous, considerate, humble? Suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So that's what the spiritual experience is like. It's a complete change in our personality, the way we see things. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's a journey, right? It's a path. In fact, I've been trying to produce such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the method I employed was successful, but I've not been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Therapy didn't do it. Therapy is more self-knowledge. Therapy may be good, but we have to take action. So how do we have these ideas, emotions, and attitudes suddenly cast aside? A new set of concepts and motives come in. How do we have this huge emotional displacement rearrangement? Well, there's a process. It has five parts to it. The first part is I have to be willing to change. I have to be willing to cast aside my old ideas. I don't want to have the same guiding forces. The second part is I have to believe I can change. Now, how do I believe I can change? I believe by coming here and seeing people change. And I change because I believe that there's a power that can change me. What's the third thing we have to do? We have to decide to change and have God as our director. Now, that's not too complicated, is it? All right, if you do those three things, nothing happens. You have to do the fourth thing. You have to take the action, the change. And then you're changed and you have faith and trust in God. And that's the spiritual experience. You don't get it by deciding to do it. You have to be willing. You have to believe. You make the decision. You take the actions of 4 through 9. You live in step 10, 11, and 12. You have a relationship with God. You live in the world of the Spirit. They're not going to tell you this now because then nobody will read further, because it's page 26, and they're going to take a while, because upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected, after all, he was a good church member, right? I hear people all the time that say, well, that's okay, I believe in God, I pray a lot. They pray and get in their car and run their life. And then the day turns to, crap, and then they blame God. I prayed in the morning and my day was crap. What the hell are you doing? Well, they didn't let God work in their lives, right? This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, it did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. And we read last week the Appendix 2 on the vital spiritual experience. And notice, convictions without actions, the result is nil. I can't remember the phrase, but it's something without action is fantasy. Does anybody remember? It's at the meetings. Is it thoughts without action is fantasy? Yeah. So we have a lot of fantasies in here. Fantasy doesn't work. It has to be with actions. And so then here was the terrible dilemma that he found himself. It's a dilemma. He didn't know how to do this, right? When he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we've already told you, made him a free man. So what happened to Rowan Hazard? He went to New York to the Calvary Church with Reverend Shoemaker. He went to the Oxford Group. He worked the steps. He had a spiritual change. He was sober. And about a year later, he rescued a man named Ebbie Thatcher, who was going to be put in an asylum in Vermont because he couldn't stop drinking, and he was a menace to the society. Ebbie was a good guy. He drove a car into somebody's living room. He shot up the neighborhood, and the judge was going to put him away. Now, Rowan Hazard was friends with the judge's son, and they knew Ebbie Thatcher. And he had spent summers together, because Ebbie Thatcher was from a wealthy family in Albany, New York. So he went to the judge, and the judge gave him Ebbie. He says, you can have him, but don't let him come back to Vermont. So he took Ebbie to the Calvary Church, 1934, September. Ebbie worked the steps. He had never stayed sober. 60 days, they said, Ebbie, you've got to do the sixth step, which is testimony. You have to find somebody and testify of what's happened to you. She says, do you know anybody? He says, I got the guy, Bill W., who was his childhood friend and who he drank with. He goes to Bill W. on November 12th, 1934, and they sit in his kitchen. We read that in Bill's story, and we're here today. Tell me that's not the hand of God. So then I want to read this last paragraph, this next paragraph. I don't know if I'll finish the chapter tonight. It says, we, in our turn, listen to this, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. Have anybody ever been at the beach and gotten in an undertow? I remember as a kid, it is scary. It is scary. And if you're in that, you'll grab anything, right? Now, what I'd like to see when I see new people, do they want to escape with the desperation of drowning men? See, that's what it takes to really complete defeat, the desperation of a drowning man. And I hope I always keep that. I don't want to ever get away from that. I don't want to feel like I'm not drowning today. I told Kyle, I have a hopeless condition of mind and body today without God. We don't get well here. We just find a power that gets us well. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. Wow. Anybody here agree with that? And in fact, it says if we look back, the things that happened to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could imagine. Anybody relate to that? Think about your moment of complete defeat. The flimsy reed could just be like Lenny called his old sponsor. And then things happen. I talked to Kyle tonight. Why was he and I in the same room there tonight? How did God put all those things together? The proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. God is loving and powerful. And I guarantee if you reach out and grab, God will be there for you. That's the guarantee in AA. The only guarantee we have is if you seek God, it says God can and will if you were sought. He can. And it will happen. And you will find him now. And it says a new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. Now, why do you need a design for living that really works? Because my way didn't work. Now, here's the problem, and Lenny mentioned it. If I stop doing the design for living that really works, it stops working. It's a design for living that you have to keep working it. And the new life has been given us, but to keep the new life, you have to do the work. And it says we have a daily reprieve, right? Each day by our relationship with God. So I'm going to stop there. I'll finish the chapter next week. Okay? Is that all right?
Great.
All right. Thanks, guys.